Well, welcome everybody for this very interesting conversation, religion and praxis, special issue on the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And we have a good friend of mine and a very eminent sociologist, Tanya Kalinichenko from Kiev, who holds a PhD in sociology of religion from the National Pedagogical Drahmanov University. Her thesis work was about religious components in social political conflict in modern Ukraine. And she's currently working in conflict transformation and peace building as a dialogue facilitator, trainer, and mediator. So her practical knowledge and theoretical knowledge is combined in this work. She co-created the Peace Building Initiative Dialogue in Action, helping to cooperate with the religious and secular worlds and different actors. And in addition, she's an executive director of the NGO, the Center for Strategic Analysis Analytics. And mainly her work focuses on sociology of religion, conflict studies, peace building, and reconciliation. Besides being a prolific scholar, she is also an advocate for civil liberties and an excellent teacher. And so I'm very, very thankful for you being here today, Tanya. And
thank you, Tornike. I'm happy to that I'm able actually to join.
Yeah, I will start with the context in which you gathered some of the information that you'll be talking today, but also the experience that you actually went through. So where you when the war started, and how did your trajectory develop? If you can kind of guide our listeners through this.
Yeah, actually, I'm from Kyiv and I was born in Kyiv, but since last year I was moved to Nemishaeva communities. It's close to Bucha. And I suppose that almost everyone heard something about Bucha. So we started our war here for the first 2 days. And it's actually quite close to Hostomel Airport. And you know about a lot of shellings. And then I moved to another village, Severinivka. It's close to Hostomel Road, a big road. And actually I was there under occupation, under shelling for 10 days. And then just go back to Hostomel region. And then together with my husband, we started to volunteer and then get back to our Nemishaeva community as soon as this was liberated. So quite a different experience. So
indeed,
just
indeed.
A lot of stuff to think on.
Indeed, and also it kind of to situate that your scholarly excellence in this kind of extraordinary situation is very important. I mean, again, before you guide us through the historical context and the general kind of patterns in religious field in Ukraine or legal constellations, what probably would be most interesting for the listeners to just, maybe you can provide us a little bit of the kind of broader sort of religion in Ukraine topic, religion and national identity, but also again, related to the historical context, if you kind of guide us through that, and again on the level of the elevator talk, obviously. And I know you have slides for us, but for those of us who can see it definitely, but those of our listeners who can't see the slides, if you can actually tell what's going on in the slides so that they can actually listen to that, will be great. So floor is yours, Tanya, and we are here for questions later on.
Yeah, sure, Toronto. Thanks again. And actually, just 2 minutes ago, we got another air alarm, but I suppose that everything will be fine. So it's just unpredictable when you get it. And just our lecture started. So I said, like, okay, that's, nothing changes. So what about religion and conflict transformation? So first, I just want to remind that I will be talking from both heads of my work today. So first, as scholar, as sociologist of religion. And second one is more about practical mediation, conflict transformation. So those, the time of the person that actually unites people in circles and asking them to talk and to think about different stuff, some about practical dialogues and trainings. So this is from the both parts of my identity. And just to remind you a little bit about religious situation in Ukraine, I will just show for those who can see a small photo of today's reality. Actually, on a photo, you can see a car. That's a car of one of my friends. He is military chaplain. Before, he was a Protestant pastor. In 2014, he moved to the Orthodox Church and started to be an Orthodox Church of Ukraine priest. And right now, he's serving in military forces of Ukraine. And here you can see in his really old car, I was there, and it's a miracle that it's still moving. And you can see some special stuff for the priest together with a gun. So that's all together that he carries on by himself. And also on the right side, you can see an armor vest with an image of Jesus Christ. It's something to protect. And actually you can see the holes from the bullets, but the soldiers fired. So everything is fine. And like he said, that protected him, this image of Jesus Christ on his vest. So what about Ukraine? As soon as we get all multi-ethnic and multi-religious country, that's all about our balance and overall our big situation of different churches, different religions, different ethnicities in one country. And I suppose you heard a lot from Jose Casanova about Ukraine is like similar to US sometimes, because even in Orthodoxy, we don't get one church. And even when we got a Thomas from Patriarch Bartholomew in 2018, so we created another Orthodox Church of Ukraine, we didn't get only one church. We get Ukrainian Orthodox Church of Moscow Patriarchate. We still have Ukrainian Orthodox Church of Kyiv Patriarchate, and we get one new Orthodox Church of Ukraine. Also, we get Roman Catholics, big Catholics, and of course, a lot of Protestants, and not only Christians, because there are a lot of Muslims and Jewish and Eastern religions in Ukraine, neo-pagans, some old believers, agnostics, atheists, so all together. And what personally I like about Kyiv is that only on one street you can see almost everyone. So one from Mormon church, one is close to synagogue, that's a Buddhist center, so that's all together. And we actually learn how to live in such multi-religious balance. So shortly, that's a huge more story about Orthodoxy in Ukraine, but it's complicated that we get all the kind of situations. But what I would like to focus more is it's more about the perspective of conflict transformation and talking about conflict sensitivity analysis. In conflict sensitive analysis, so first just not to intervene inside the situation, if we are scholars who are trying to investigate and to understand what's going on. We need to understand that any kind of question, any kind of interview we get, that's our intervention into the context. And that will get any kind of conclusions and impacts on people there. So I will focus on both factors I liked most, just to think about factors of division or dividers and factors of connections, what is helping people to connect with each other. So let me talk about dividers. And here on the photo, you can see one of the ruined churches, because during the Russian invasion since the 24th of February, we get, unfortunately, dozens of temples ruined. And one of it is Orthodox Church. And that's a quite symbolic photo, because almost all church is damaged, but only you can see this so-called iconostasis with a lot of icons that it's still alive and it's still like not even damaged before. So what about division? Because unfortunately, of course, religion not only helps to unite, but also helps to divide sometimes. And unfortunately, what we see, and I'm doing this field stage of work since 2013, that religious affiliation emphasizes a difference. So the most you affiliate to some church or some denomination, that not help you to unite with the others, like even if we're not talking about ecumenical studies, but in general that enforces your identity. And then you get this vision that only my church, only my religion, only my sacral group is that something that is true and others are not true. And that emphasizes the difference, especially, for example, if you get both pro-Ukrainian Greek Catholics and believers of Orthodox Church of Ukraine. That's quite complicated. What do we get? And actually, there's a second factor about religious competition and on the religious market. You can see it in the public. It's enough to open a Facebook and to find some posts from the priests, all latent. Sometimes like a corruption when you deal with the land issues and you want to build a church or another one, chapel, and it's latent. It's somewhere in the ordinary small talks, you just hear, of course, there are those who are ours and those who are not ours, like Roman Catholics in the sides of Greek Catholics, like more Ukrainian or not Ukrainian church. And it's all about connections with nationalities too. Because when we worked together with another great scholar, Denis Brilhov, we just realized that our connection to nationalism is more about ethnicity than religiosity. Because you know about a quite interesting phenomenon in Ukraine, Orthodox atheists, those who say that I'm Orthodox and I do not believe in God. That's enough for me because I'm Ukrainian and I should be Orthodox. But actually, that's not true because we get totally different people and the percentage is not the highest one. So that's all about religious competition and also in the field of, for example, Islam and Jewish and Judaism, because in general, as it doesn't help. So it's like a religious market, but what helps it is a balanced way of market. So it's possible, for example, to enforce your religious organization or not, and just to compete with the others, but to still keep going with this balance. And still, since the beginning of the Maidani protests and then war on Donbass, and still now, we don't get any kind of shared vision of peace by the religious organizations, unfortunately. Of course, we get some peace-building strategy adapted from all Ukrainian Council of Churches and religious organizations. Still, it's not practical. So, for example, if you're a believer and you ask the priest, what does peace mean? You don't get any kind of response, at least, for example, that minister that who was thinking a lot about peace and peace building understands. Now it can be like a bad word right now because we need victory, not peace. But what do you mean by that? And actually the churches could be that place where you can like actually think about what do we mean by peace and what do we mean by peace in our country in the future. And of course, it's a lot of hate sharing and language. Unfortunately, it's more about political position, about personal vision, and still get it. And I'm really thankful for social media that we actually observe it. And sometimes you don't even need to talk. You just open some Instagram or Facebook or Twitter and you see everything. So what about connectors? Something about positive, because it's not only about negative side of potential for conflict transformation. And here on the photo, you can see one of the soldiers of Ukrainian army standing in an Orthodox temple. And actually, that's quite symbolic photos because he is praying with his open hands and the sun is just lying on his hands. I really like this photo. So connectors. And what I really like about Ukraine, that's all about why it's social and cultural capital. Promoted and actually gained by religious actors. That's not only about ministers, priests, pastors, imams, rabbi, that's not only about them, that's about ordinary believers. Because for example, I can call to one imam who is a military chaplain, then I can be connected to another Protestant pastor. So that's all about horizontal networks of connection and they're really working. For example, when the war started and I was volunteering in 2014, that took not a lot of time to connect with all together who were active since that time, and we can help each other. And also, that's a quite specific another potential from Roman Catholic Church and Ukrainian Orthodox Church of Moscow Patriarchate. Who are those churches, special churches, that they get parishes in every region of Ukraine, and sometimes they get more mandate to get peace making and peace negotiations. Unfortunately, that doesn't work so much in practice. For example, as it works in other countries by Roman Catholic Church and Vatican diplomacy, but we're still thinking about it. And if it's possible, and especially in today's narrative by Pope Francis, to use it and just to make this as connection, but not disconnection. And right now I'm observing and hoping that will be everything okay with humanitarian aid to Mariupol. Because a lot of people were saying, so if we believe in Moscow and Ruski or Mir, so let's hope for Ukrainian Orthodox Church of Moscow Patriarchate to come and to open this green corridor for helping people. So there are several priests and bishops there who are trying to organize it in negotiations with Russian troops. So we'll see what we will get. But anyway, they are trying to do something as it's possible. Of course, we also get new religious generation of pastors, of priests. They are more young people, they read a lot. And there is a big hope that it would be possible to change the vision of the church and to get not it as a classical one, but also in another practices of everyday diplomacy and everyday speaking, talking with each other, connecting with others. And of course, it's more about charismatic leaders on the places. Because if a priest is a charismatic leader, if he gets or she in different denominations, gets a lot of connections, gets authority from local community, that's the right place to come and to connect with everyone, with the mayor of the city, with a local businessman, with the oligarch, with the policeman. So you get everyone just from one priest. And it's all about that can be in the result of common actions, projects, and statements. And that's actually what we are working for in our Dialogue Connection initiative, because we're trying to mobilize them and to improve this interconnection with religious and secular world and to open new perspectives. And of course, there are some new sacred symbols which I collected. There's much more, but I will just explain a little bit. And more, it's about women role and role of the mother. That's actually, that's a photo of one of the mother with a really small child breastfeeding. And actually it was done in a way of icon with stars of Virgin Mary. And that's another one photo which actually get even abroad from the mother from Kyiv subway who is breastfeeding her small child. Then it was done as a picture. And then this picture moved to Naples in Italy for Easter service in Roman Catholic parish. So it's interesting how it's moving and actually its emphasis on mother's role and woman role during this new stage of Ukraine. So that's just really briefly, because I know that you get a lot of questions and also about theoretical approach and about mixed methodology that maybe we can collect some questions and then go on.
Thank you. I think I'll go from some of the questions which I have, and then just remind the audience that you can write your questions in the chat and I'll be reading them. So my first question was related to you mentioned that Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Moscow Patriarchate, or as legally called the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, is targeted by the Russian invaders. And I wonder if that targeting is deliberate for the sake of just punishing Onufri for being at this point and at this phase kind of on the side of Ukraine. And can you please also guide us through the position of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Moscow Patriarchate throughout the first the Crimea annexation and then the Donbas war, and how does the position of the church change and in what directions, and what's the kind of the culmination of this position?
Yeah, thanks for your question. Actually, I would say that it didn't change till the end. So we cannot say precisely that today is its position like that officially, in like Patriarch Kirill, especially not even using this word special operation right now as they call it in Ukraine. So it's all about changing narratives and more about theological and philosophical background. Since the beginning of 2013 and the Crimean annexation and Donbas conflict, we get different positions from Metropolitan Onufri, who actually was thinking more about standing above the conflict. And we get a lot of public scandals about it with position of different bishops of Moscow Patriarchate. But we need to understand that position of one bishop doesn't mean the position of the whole church. And that's really important. And that's actually what the special gap that Onufri is trying to stand above the conflict and to think about Christian way of living and more living for the day, the life after death, but not living today in Ukraine. And that's special about Orthodox theology and point of view our everyday lives, that it's something that from ordinary world, but we are living for a spiritual world and for a spiritual future. And it's more as it's actually coming from Russian Orthodox Church perspective. And actually, if we talk about targeting in the future, I'm still waiting for the results of open statement from several bishops from Moscow Patriarchate in Ukraine to Patriarch Bartholomew, asking to get autocephaly for them. That's actually a good dilemma and understanding what's going on and how we can actually proceed with this conflict, because the only thing that it's now understandable that it wouldn't last like it was before. So definitely, Ukrainian Orthodox Church of Moscow Patriarchate will change, but we need to understand on which way. I'm really grateful, for example, for good and honest position of the state right now, because we got different law projects on renaming the church, on changing parishes and etc. of like Russian Orthodox Church in Ukraine. But actually, the President Zelensky just stopped this initiative and said that now we have war, and then we will talk about in the end of the war. But there are some small cases like mayors of the cities denied and stopped official work of Moscow Patriarchate in several cities, just denied for them till the end of the war to get any kind of service. So this all kind of precedents. And about targeting and shelling on the temples, of course, all the artillery systems, they do not shoot like in different occasion just to shoot and to shell because they get some tasks on how many they should do it. But anyway, I do not think that it's partially only because of the position of Ukraine. I suppose it's more about damaging cultural heritage and trying to ruin different cultural places, as we saw it before, and especially in Chernihiv, as a really old city, and a lot of the city center ruined just because of the shelling. So I suppose it's not only about temples, especially for Moscow Patriarchate, but one of the symbolic places is Svetogirsk Lavra, and it was under shelling before, and one of the main temples was ruined on the 8th of May. I suppose it could be a special task, but I cannot know precisely. So definitely we need just to count and to monitor what's going on, and we will know everything till the end, and maybe as soon as we open all the documents.
Another question which I'm interested in is that, well, you mentioned about the mandate for peace building. I think it's a fascinating theme to delve deeper into that. So the Ukraine Orthodox Church of the Moscow Patriarchate has more mandate for peace building in the sense of the parishes, amount of parishes, and its physical presence on the territories of Ukraine by and large. But how can it be after this whole thing? How this mandate can be utilized? I mean, I know both of us are sociologists, and futurism is not the cup of our tea. We don't like to predict stuff, given that it most of the time doesn't work as we predict. So I wonder what's the sort of the nature here of the status when the trust is broken? How can the trust be rebuilt?
Trust was broken before, but it's not broken for different kinds of people. And when I'm talking about mandate for peace building, I mean mainly several main characteristics. Like first, in overall, they get a peaceful or peace building narrative in general. So then I do not talk only about pro-Ukrainian and pro-Russian churches. And for example, like some priests of Kyiv Patriarchate or Orthodox Church of Ukraine calling only to stand with pro-Ukrainian church as soon as you are Ukrainian. So it doesn't help to connect. I'm not thinking about right or false, but it's all about connection from different social categories. And still there are a lot of believers of Moscow Patriarchate in Ukraine who are connected to the parish and who are connected because of their spiritual life, but not because of their political position. And actually, it's more about this mandate that they are connected in different regions and they are still staying in Donetsk, in Lugansk, in Crimean Peninsula, they're still there. And they are all connected with different even pro-Russian groups of population. Those people who cannot, for example, go to Orthodox Church of Ukraine or Greek Catholic Church because of their political position. So that's all about mandate. As they use it, not a lot. And of course, it's not about peace building as it could be, because of course, we knew about some initiative before from different politicians to get this Moscow Patriarchate as a peacemaker, but it didn't work because people do not trust, other categories of people do not trust. The only thing we can change now was humanitarian aid in Donetsk, Lugansk, but it's like a simple aid with, of course, some political messages. So they're not neutral. For example, if they're taking this help from Russian troops and just receiving it and getting it with some political messages. They're not neutral anymore. It's not about only spiritual help. And then the other way, this humanitarian corridor to Mariupol. That could be a real help because they can be those who are in negotiations. But we saw a political life of, for example, a well-known Viktor Medvedchuk, who didn't succeed, but he was not a negotiator officially. So we can see it on rural places, in small locations, when, for example, we exchange those who are in prison, soldiers who are in prison, and that actually works. And that all depends, again, on personalities. For example, those priests who are staying in occupied territories from Moscow Patriarchat, who are pro-Ukrainian, and they are helping people, and they still survive. And I do believe it would be possible to talk to them in the end and to understand all the complexity of this identity which is going on.
Thank you very much for this response. I wonder, well, if you can guide us through the nature of religiosity in Ukraine in the light of this phenomena, which I think we both talked in a bit, but didn't elaborate that much on Kathy Warner's workshop where we met last time. So the numbers so far suggest that people do not switch by and large to the Russian Orthodox Church in Ukraine. So basically, for those who don't follow the religious field, Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Moscow Patriarchate is still by and large in advance, and they have more parishes than the newly created church. I think it's 12,000 against 7,000, something like that. No?
It's less, I would say, because there are a lot of so-called empty parishes. Because on the paper, we still have it. But when you see them physically, they're not acting anymore and they're not active. So even we don't get one priest there. I would say that maybe 9,000 anyway, but it's like half and half now in OCU is growing up. Of course, it's not a big number of parishes moving on, but anyway, they're growing. So we need to think more about the quality of this parish. But anyway,
precisely the quality question. The quality, definitely. But the puzzle, which I think is really interesting to kind of unfold and understand sociologically, is that what is the causal effect of this war on religious behavior? And one dimension of this question is, of course, that still there is a low number of people who switch from the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of Russian Patriarchate or of Moscow Patriarchate to the new church. Is it because of the war that people are just waiting because it's a catastrophe ongoing and they're just trying to save their lives? Or is it because the nature of religiosity in Ukraine is very distinct? So they don't care so much which church denomination they go to as long as they are practicing religion. What will be your take on that?
It's a complicated problem. And I know that you were doing research on it and it changes parishes, and you know that it's a complex problem. So it's not only about people do not know to which church they do belong, but actually sometimes it's true. So to what church are you going? I'm going to the closest church, and that's Ukrainian church, because accordingly to this official name of the church, on the table, just on the front, you can see Ukrainian Orthodox Church, that's all. That doesn't say anything about Moscow Patriarchate. Of course, then from people to people, from local citizens, you can hear that that's Moscow priest and that's Ukrainian priest, more naming about that. But of course, sometimes it's more about identity and parish identity of Moscow Patriarchate believers, because some of them are really fixed and they do like their parish. For example, in Kiev, Pechersklavra, or in some rural areas, in their small villages, that's not about Moscow Patriarchate, but that's about canonical church for them from their birth, for example, when they were baptized there, then get a marriage, then they baptize their children. So that's more about loyalty to the place and loyalty to the priest. And for example, if priest is not like open pro-Russian, if he's not like calling to go to Moscow or calling to Patriarch Kirill, he's more about neutral and more about spiritual leader, then he's a good one. So parish do not want to change themselves and to change identity to Orthodox Church of Ukraine, or in some cases to Ukrainian Greek Catholic churches. We get even like those cases. But also that's about personalities, the way of service, the way of political moods. And for example, a lot of callings which I hear from changes of a parish, that's more from secular people who do not go to the church every Sunday. But in those small, really small communities of Moscow Patriarchate, in some small villages, for example, with grandmothers and grandfathers coming there, they are actually more belonging to the church. And they are going every Sunday, not like to the Easter or Christmas service. So they are really belonging there, and it could be like a small parish, but they cannot change. And of course, if you want to change officially, you need to collect all the documents, you need a council of church, you need all the official statements. And some of the parish changes that we see on the media, they are not done officially. So it needs to be registered and everything should be fine. And also, of course, I cannot say about statistics nowadays because our department on religious affairs is not working on uncovering all the statistics because it's not possible today. So we need to wait and to understand the new numbers. And of course, to understand how many people do we get. And as not many researchers do, just to go step by step from one village to another and to check what do we have in services. Because a lot of people, for example, as in our small village in our community, we have several churches, and a lot of people changed without changing parish name. So they just moved and they, for example, for Easter, they came not from Moscow Patriarchate, but to Orthodox Church of Ukraine for the service. So you cannot count them because you can only see them. But there it's more about personal choice. So I don't want to provoke like church council, but it's okay for me to just to go a little bit more kilometers and to go to another service. So that's anyway we need to observe.
And the question that it kind of builds on your observations is how to trust data then? Because how do we know what we know? Very kind of epistemological question. Given that the whole statistical procedures are complicated and the registration is logistically complicated given the situation, how do we know the data is accurate per se? I mean, whether the state data or sort of the sociological data. So what's your take on the data kind of proceeding? I mean, we need to measure by some sort of measurement to see the patterns, whether they change or they replicate something ongoing or how the churches respond. And as we know, because we've done research together and also I've done field work in Ukraine in more than 100 parishes across the country in different parts of time. And so in my own experience of doing research in Ukraine, it's definitely proves your theory that it's difficult to just say, well, this is the statistically accurate. You go to the parish and it's officially registered on Moscow Patriarchate, but it actually is already way in the Kiev Patriarchate at the time when I was there and in later times in Orthodox Church of Ukraine. So these data are quite complicated. So what's your solution to that?
Good question and good issue. Just maybe not for me personally, but for the State Department, definitely, on religious affairs and ethnic political affairs, because it's definitely need to be counted in different ways. And for example, as in our one of the villages nearby, we get one temple. In a temple, inside, there's a Moscow Patriarchate, but outside on the backyard, without any building, we get Orthodox Church of Ukraine. So how we can count this parish? Well, one and a half, so one and one, what do we think about it? And actually, it's more about different ways, different methods of collecting. Of course, according to quantitative sociology, it's possible to count. And for example, we talked a lot with Razumkov Center and Kiev Institute of Sociology, and it differs on how, on the way how you form the question. And it's really interesting. And a position of varieties of choice, that for example, Moscow Patriarchate could be the first, and Kiev Patriarchate the second, or Ukrainian Orthodox Church, and it got different, total different numbers. And one of the main interesting parts of society on which we're talking a lot, it's about just Orthodox. Yeah, before close to 25% of people, so they don't want to belong to any church. They are just Christians. So what do you mean by that? Actually, I'm still standing for qualitative sociology because personally, I like in-depth interviews, observing and understanding, but it's not representative for the whole Ukraine because it's almost impossible. Of course, 100 parishes in your research, that's a really good result. But anyways, it's need a lot of money and the funds to travel and to catch everything and to find everyone through different contacts. And of course, it's more about trust in different numbers. So we can use statistics and we can use quantitative data as we use it just to general situation description. And then we need to go on the places. For me personally, a good decision just to reinforce this regional representatives of State Department so they can not only collect numbers, but also going by step to step physically from one parish to another and to understand what's going on there. That need to be another way of structuring their work, but anyways, it should be really interesting just to see it. And of course, we get several researchers who are doing this field stage, so it's possible to collect and to understand. But anyway, we should think about representative of those data and not to say that now I know about whole situation of Ukraine. I know a lot of priests, but they cannot say for the whole Moscow Patriarchate or for the whole Orthodox Church of Ukraine that they know the situation. But they can collect from one point to another and check different regions and check different networks. And it gives different data in general. And we can, of course, check narrative analysis, context analysis, then personal biographical method, and do all the mix. Because religion is a complicated topic, you know.
Yeah, thank you. So I'll not abuse my position. So I have a few questions. First is from Nana Gabelia from Berlin. So a question is, how does war change people's more soldiers' perspective of religion and Christianity? Can we say that people become more strong in their beliefs or vice versa? And does winning or losing war can shake or strengthen religious beliefs?
I would say this is more about personal understanding because I know a lot of believers who went to serve on the front line and they lost their belief and faith just because they understood that that's not enough explanation for them. And as soon as they lost their friends on the front line, they understood they didn't believe in God anymore. And of course, a lot of people who were agnostic or atheists before, and I read that a lot in social media, that's not only about Christians, but in general, that they say, okay, so now I can believe in something because I saw one of the occasion or one miracle or another. My house is not ruined when the whole street is ruined. So now I can believe in God because only God could protect it from shelling. So the well-known phrase that there are no atheists in the front line, maybe that's true. And from my personal experience working with soldiers and officers, it's more about standing for believing and understanding, but sometimes it doesn't correspond with belonging to some religion. It's more about personal experience. If you get this personal experience on standing on the line between life and death, they can definitely change you. And of course, you can lose your religion because of a lot of pain and grief you have in you. And when you don't get any kind of explanations from, for example, your religious affiliation leaders. I hope that I answered your question.
Thank you. Two other questions. First one is, the question basically is that whether you think that this humanitarian procedures can save the face of the Russian Orthodox Church in Ukraine, whether or not they will contribute to the humanitarian action. Can that be the sort of the context under which they can, you know, be still among the most trusted institutions or kind of get into this kind of soul of the society, if you will?
I don't think that would save the overall image. And I would say that no, they will not create a lot of trust for them. But anyway, that will be a good precedent for them. Because sometimes it's when they got a lot of crashes and attacks from pro-Ukrainian people and those who are trying to change the Moscow Patriarchate, then they cannot say something instead. So, for example, of course, we get some humanitarian projects, but mainly they're not so public. But this could be a really good case, and especially for those hundreds and thousands of people calling to save Mariupol and especially Azovstal. So it would be possible get this case. And of course, there are a lot of believers who are now serving from Moscow Patriarchate on the front line. That was not true in 2014 before, because there were not a lot of like strong believers of Moscow Patriarchate. fighting, but now that's true. And especially, of course, one of the cases is of this well-known boxer, Alexander Usyk, who was more about pro-Crimean. And as he said personally in a lot of his interviews, I'm pro-Christ and more pro-Christian. So not about pro-Ukrainian or pro-Russian, but talking about the spiritual level of life. But as you know, his house was destroyed and now he is serving for the Ukrainian army. So this position changed. And that's little by little different images of those people. So it's really important to get not only black and white views of those good church with good guys, that's a bad church with bad guys, and that we can talk only about bad and good, but it's more about complicated gray zones of the conflict, and especially at war, when it's all about pain and losses, and it's not about positive images at all.
The question is there a conflict between the Greek Catholic Church and the Russian Orthodox Church in Ukraine at the moment?
Officially not. Officially, they are all in the only Ukrainian Council of Churches and Religious Organizations. But of course, if you can see on the public events in Ukraine, almost in all events, we do not see representatives of Moscow Patriarchate right now, because they are trying to ignore or they are not attending these mutual prayers, even for peace with the president and others. Officially, they are all in contact. But of course, it differs on a personal level, on the level of bishops, but they still, they were trying to connect, and I was speaking with one of the responsible person from Greek Catholic Church during these 8 years. And they said that they were trying to negotiate and to change the way of relationship in the union, in the church union, and also trying to invite them just to join, and then they denied because they didn't get personal connection. But anyway, I know that can be different on a local level, because there could be a local Greek Catholic priest together with the Moscow Patriarchate priest who are friends and who are helping each other. That could be more about personal level of connection.
We have a few more questions, but I will select two more. And please, people who are participating through Zoom, you can use the hand raise and I will try to voice your question. So the question is, as many theologians argued, the Russian Orthodox Church in Ukraine laid the foundation for this war. Do you agree with that?
Russian Orthodox Church trying to build a narrative of, how to say it correctly, to make it a good practice of war here, and they're trying to explain the way of war in Ukraine as a God's service. And you can see it from the preachers of Patriarch Kirill. So sometimes he's really honest in his own motivation. So I suppose it's a huge case for Orthodox world in on geopolitical level, just to think about his preachers and theological perspective and the theology of war. And it's enough even to read a social doctrine of Russian Orthodox Church and to understand. But Patriarch Kirill position, does it mean that the whole position of every priest and bishop of Russian Orthodox Church, and we know about different political camps inside it. So we need to think and to compare and also to wait what we will get in the end. And also from, for example, from Greece, from Serbian Church and about Georgian Orthodox Church. So it's all about different positions. And of course, that's more about on prolongation of the conflict between Patriarch Bartholomew and Patriarch Kirill, which started from on another level from creating of Orthodox Church in Ukraine. So it would be really interesting to understand how that will be.
Of course, the big issue is whether or not the ongoing war will reflect the general sentiment among other sister Orthodox churches, and whether they will recognize give the Thomas or recognize the autocephaly of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, in what capacity will the Patriarch of Constantinople act. And generally, so far, we see contentious situation, contentious politics, if you will, between the Orthodox churches. We're seeing also that the Serbian Orthodox Patriarch is maybe evolving into this mediating figure between Kirill and Onufri. Whether it's true or not, of course, one can speculate, but definitely this, a few recent visits, conversations, Zoom conversations between the two patriarchs, and the general sentiment of the conversation and the role of Serbian Orthodox Church in the humanitarian action, and also in support of the Ukrainian refugees is interesting. What sort of final destination will that get us to? Another issue is, of course, this idea of spiritual geopolitics, and also we worked on this in our own research, whether and to what extent the sort of Orthodox Christianity gives an overarching frame to that, or whether the state uses the Orthodox Christianity for its geopolitical ambitions. So that's a sort of an open question, which again, that needs to be tested across the scale and comparative perspective is, as you know, a complicated matter across whether we're talking about, you know, historical analysis or sociological analysis and various factors which we need to consider. So yeah, I mean, yes and no answers are definitely reductionist in such a complicated and interdependent sort of constellations, which we're
especially having. In the case of the Orthodox Church, we need to remember that it is focused on national churches, not like religions. So it's more about connection with ethnic perspective. So there's more complicated on these clashes of identities nowadays. And it's like standing still from Russian position, European world or European Christianity and like true Christianity. So what do we mean by that? That's really interesting to observe too.
And the question is the presence of Islam at the moment in Ukraine, whether or not Islam is having its function for, you know, rebuilding and connection. What kind of function does it have in the conflict at the moment?
Islam is present, definitely, as it's not more in focus as Orthodoxy because of the numbers. But anyway, Muslims are really active, and especially Muslim chaplains on the front line from different spiritual administration. One of the main is spiritual administration of Muslims of Ukraine. Then another one, spiritual administrations of Muslim of Ukraine, Umma, and another spiritual administration of Crimean Tatars in Ukraine. So they were attempts to create separate union. So they all disconnected and there is a conflict between them. So there's a typical situation for most of religion in Ukraine just to get conflict inside their own. So they are really active. They get a lot of humanitarian projects. They're trying to help. And as far as I know, a lot of mosques in different regions of Ukraine, they are serving as humanitarian hubs, not only for Muslims, but also for different people who are seeking some hubs and hosts, and they want to get another night in a safe zone or get some supply, food, medicine, everything is active. So that's still there present, and especially that's a focus worry about Crimea with Crimean Tatars. And they're present on the other level as like Chechen volunteers on the front line, another in this complicated situation with Kadyrov, for example. And these changes also on ethnical background and on political background. And it's the way of sometimes it's Ukraine as a laboratory for resolving other way of conflicts. And like Chechen conflicts too, or Afghan, just to meet here Kadyrov and Chechen volunteers all together on the front line fighting again. So that's all like about complicated networks of connection we get now.
I'm wondering, well, there are different questions, of course, but one of them will be maybe the significance of Ukraine for Russia. Historically, and in this case, if you can explain us why it's so important for the Russian Orthodox Church not to lose Ukrainian parishes. So what is the historical story behind for those of us who know this, of course, is having a significance, but for those who don't follow this discussion, would you guide us through this historical importance of the Ukrainian territory for the Russian Orthodox Church?
Of course, I'm not church historian, so I will not go deeply inside of it. But anyway, according to our actual information and actual statistics right now, Ukrainian parishes sometimes are even bigger and much more developed as its quality of the parish of Orthodox believers in Ukraine is much higher because Russian Orthodox Church in Russia, they are losing their position. Of course, they are present on a public level, and they are like present in the statesmen. It's connected with the president, Putin. Anyway, they are so strongly on a public level, and they are not so strong on the rural areas. And it's not about belonging and believing. It's not about image of them. And according to different data and from Levada Center, sociological from Russia, we can see how the numbers are changing. And of course, if we go back to history, that's more about creation of Moscow Patriarchate and about this issue of Ukrainian church and issue of Unia with Greek Catholics. It's all about complicated before, but previously more deep historical roots from Kyiv first and from Kyiv and Ukraine as a spiritual background and academia and first theological education. And as it's a process that do not like to hear a lot of Russians, and especially about the old history of Ukraine and the creation of Moscow kingdom first and then Russia as a big one. So it's all about historical perspective, so I will not go deeply inside of it. But anyways, it's another case which is much more interesting, maybe from this perspective, from Protestant communities, especially as soon as a lot of Protestants are now prohibited in Russian Federation, according to the law, almost all, like big percentage of Protestants were created after Ukrainian parts, thanks to American pastors, of course, who came and baptized a lot of people. So then Ukrainian evangelicals, for example, moved to Russia, and just they created evangelization centers there. So it's more about complexity of theological backgrounds and relations between countries. And it's totally different historical background according to canonical history. But anyway, that's better to go to not too deeply into the history.
Yes, thank you. And one more question. Here, and please also the Zoom, use the Zoom Q&A. So another question is if you can help us to understand this sort of religious problematic now, what's the biggest challenge which Ukraine faces? Is it the division between the Orthodox churches, or is it the sort of the confrontation between the Russia and Ukraine? Obviously, the question is sort of putting whether the war or religion is a major issue. And here I think it's quite obvious that we're dealing with existential crisis for the state, and obviously religious conflicts are accompanying. I don't know what's your comment, but at the moment, yeah, definitely it's overwhelmingly on the side of the
definitely. Of course, we got the Orthodox dilemma, an Orthodox dilemma for example, Christians, even Christians from Orthodox community, and those who were calling each other brothers on spiritual level. I'm not talking this national perspective of this Russian world concept. So anyway, that's one way of dilemma. Then we get dilemma from Pope Francis and misunderstanding of Catholic roots and, for example, relations between Roman Catholic and Greek Catholic Church in Ukraine, and relation with Vatican in general. And if we're not taking into account some Islamic roots, Jewish roots, and other, because a lot of, I would say that's existential crash for almost all religious movements and religious group, and especially as we see even from New Age groups and esoteric groups and those yoga adepts and others, they are all facing this dilemma. What should we do and how we should react? Should we stay on such spiritual level about the conflict and to say that it doesn't matter, we should just keep peace inside of us and that's all, or we need to act, or we need to do something? And I would say that the biggest dilemma that we will get more, and that's much more interesting for me, how religion responds to such conflicts, how religion responds and explain the root of the war, and how it's possible to keep peace in war, in yourself, and after the war in society. So how it's possible to reconcile. It's more about conflict transformation, key question. So what's next? What we will get in one generation, in two generations, in 50 years? What we will get in the end, and how we should move to it? Is it possible to think in a strategic way? Because definitely we need. Of course, it's impossible when you get a lot of crisis every day, a lot of shellings and bombings going on. But anyway, that's a role of the church, one of the possible roles to understand how we should move. And there are there any spiritual backgrounds and spiritual stabilization platform or religious coping with the trauma? So would it be possible for ministries, for different religious leaders to respond and to guide people through it? Or they will just react on some crisis in the end when it's too late? That's one of the biggest dilemma, I would say, more to think of, and to think where we will get empty churches or we will get new strong generation of believers and leaders.
And the last question of from my side will be, well, it kind of builds on my next meeting with Father Nicholas Denisenko, who I'll be hosting in May for the Religion and Praxis Conversation series. And the question which we will leave and we'll finish this conversation will be whether you think that Orthodox Christianity needs a restart after this war, because it put Orthodox Christianity in a, you know, yes and no situation, which is not very accommodated to act because of its historical roots in Sinfonia and other sort of clientelistic practices, or it's kind of the ethnophiletic practices and etc. It was historically difficult for the churches to be really very clear when it comes to their social and political strategy, or if you will, or doctrines. So I'm wondering if you, how would you comment on that, on the future of Orthodoxy after this ongoing invasion?
I would say it's not only about Orthodoxy, it's about each religious movement, because it's a point of crisis, really deep existential crisis, which we'll get more and more after the end of the war. So it's more about how do we move and should we restart? And I think that's a good point. It's in each crisis, we get the energy to change something. And that's a good point to rethink everything and rethink everyday life and our service and way of spiritual life. And for Orthodoxy, I think that's unprecedented crisis which we get before with the conflicts among patriarchs and this clash of different churches into different political camps, but also to think more in theological perspective, because we will get some cases and some works only now, and definitely that should prolong in the theology of war, and which, for example, we are trying to rethink with our groups of believers and religious actors on theology of peace or theology of life. Is possible to think about, because some of theologians in Ukraine, they're trying to develop the theology of hospitality, theology of hugs, theology of love. So could we speak about such ordinary things, but in different way, in a way of spiritual practice? So how would it be possible to change? And definitely that should be more on a consciousness level and more about everyday services. So liturgy doesn't help us to understand the answers to hard questions, hot topics and dilemmas, which we get a lot right now.
Many thanks, Tanya. It was wonderful to talk to you, and my apologies to the to those participants who asked questions and I couldn't read them. And I'm very grateful for your attendance and for your heroic work that you've been doing in these extreme times. And all the best to you and your family, and I hope you'll be safe. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you. Stay safe too. Bye.